Hey everyone, how's it going? I'm here today with clinical psychologist Dr. Will Baroni. He is a psychologist in Oakland, California, who is actually studying in the field of psychedelic medication and treatment for patients, right?
That's right. Yeah, so I'm a clinical psychologist. I focus on working with a range of mental health issues, both in traditional settings and using psychedelic medications. Currently, we're clinically using ketamine as a medication-assisted treatment for a number of conditions. And I'm also a researcher of psychedelic-assisted therapies, where I've worked on researching MDMA, psilocybin, and ketamine as treatments for different conditions.
Wow. With patients, like one-on-one work?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So we could talk later about what these treatments look like and how some of those substances, the treatments look a little different because all of these substances, whether we're talking about psilocybin or MDMA or ketamine, they all have their kind of different way of going about being a treatment medication.
Interesting. How did you get in the line of work of this stuff? What brought you in that field?
Yeah, so you know, for years in my training, so in undergrad, I focused on biological psychology, and I've always been fascinated by the brain and neurobiology and how our physiology works and creates our experience of consciousness. And I was always also very interested in the neurobiology of substance use and how medications and substances can alter our consciousness and our awareness and the way we experience the world and ourselves. So I was originally focused on the neurobiology of addiction and focused a lot on substance abuse and use and dependence and focusing on harm reduction measures for treating substance abuse. But I also was aware of some of the work that was happening, some of the modern research with MDMA as a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, which MAPS has been doing for almost two decades. Even though they started in about 1986, the clinical trials were really getting going from the early mid-2000s.
Interesting. And for those people who don't know, MAPS is what?
So MAPS is the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. So they are a nonprofit organization. They have been billed as a nonprofit pharmaceutical company that has been pretty solely focused on the development of MDMA and other psychedelics as clinically approved medications.
Wow! Wow! So they're like the forefront fighters for the movement of the legalization medically of that, right?
They're one of the tiers. So
cool.
There's a small handful of groups that are running this movement. MAPS has really been on the forefront, specifically with MDMA.
Wow.
So they have taken MDMA from a Schedule I illegal substance to really being part of the discussion as a powerful treatment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who are coming into this for the first time hearing about this, who have this dogma built up around psychedelics or just drugs in general, the use of drugs, you know, especially saying replacing one drug for another drug, how would you approach someone who is new to this and kind of, you know, stigmatized by this subject in general?
Absolutely. I think that's a reasonable response for anybody to have, to have that thought that it's like, wait, you're giving what to who? Like, you're giving these illegal substances to people with post-traumatic stress disorder or people with depression and suicidality. So it can be a little bit hard to grasp this idea that, you know, people are getting these drugs that for many years we've been told are really terrible and people should never do. But something that is important to know is that, one, we're not in any way just giving people MDMA, the base drug of ecstasy, to take home and just take on their own and go to a dance party. All of these substances are being used in the context of intensive therapy. And the goal with each one of these, when we use psychedelic substances, really what we're looking at is for somebody to take this medication in combination with therapy of a limited amount of times to create long-term change. So for example, with any medication, any pharmaceutical that people take, they generally have to take it every single day to have benefit. They have to deal with the side effects, the dependence, the reliance on pharmaceutical companies. And if they ever stop those medications, it's common that the symptoms return and sometimes can be worse. When we're talking about psychedelic medications, usually what this treatment looks like is it's usually between 1 and 3 uses of the medicine. So with MDMA, for example, in the treatment of severe and treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder, where everybody in our trials has been through multiple other therapies and not gotten any better, they do 3 sessions of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy over a 3-month period. So they do 1 session per month, in addition to more psychotherapy in between. And we're seeing that from those 3 sessions, the vast majority of people no longer have symptoms of PTSD after this treatment.
Wow.
So
that's the idea is these medications are... That's like a lifetime of work and years of therapy done in 3 months' time. That's pretty impressive work.
Right.
Are the
results, that's one of the things that...
Are the results pretty accurate? Are they pretty predictable?
So at this point, MDMA, for example, has been through... it's completed phase 2 clinical trials and is currently in phase 3 FDA clinical trials, which is the final round of clinical trials before it's approved as a medication. And from the phase 2 clinical trials, which had over 100 participants in various trials across the US and in other places around the world, it was found that, so while everybody in these trials had treatment-resistant severe post-traumatic stress disorder, like I said, had been through other treatments and not gotten better, and are in the highest severity of what we look at as post-traumatic stress disorder, something like 3/4 of the people who did this treatment no longer met criteria for PTSD after the study was completed.
3/4?
So 3/4, I think it was 78%. Participants no longer meet criteria for PTSD, and something even more beyond that. So when you look at that data alone, like that's unheard of. There's no medication or therapy or treatment that has, you know, after a 3-month period, almost anybody not diagnosable for PTSD anymore. But with this medication, with MDMA, you have those people who, after this treatment, no longer diagnosable for PTSD.
Wow.
But what I found in one of my studies, which was a qualitative follow-up where I interviewed these participants 1 year after they went through this treatment, one of the important findings from that was that even those people who were still diagnosable for PTSD, many of them said that this was one of the most important experiences of their life.
Wow.
That even though they still may have PTSD symptoms, their quality of life had improved dramatically, the way they exist in the world, the way they deal with their issues.
Wow.
All of these benefits have come out of this. And a big part of this is that the purpose of these medications, it's not that they're a magic bullet that just solves problems, but what they can do is they create an atmosphere for someone to do intensive therapy. So with MDMA, for example, after I've studied this for the last 8 years or so, I've come to the understanding that it's not necessarily MDMA that's solving the problem. It's actually this intensive therapy process where somebody can go in and have access to their traumas and access to these experiences in a way that they've never had had access before.
Because you're experiencing those with like a different emotion, right? With MDMA. You're experiencing that trauma with a different feeling completely.
Right. So when someone has PTSD, they actually have a number of systems that block them from being able to access traumatic memories normally. So their brain is really trying to stop them from having to feel those traumatic experiences again. And so there's a number of ways that it does that. One of those is called dissociation. So when a traumatic memory is triggered, somebody kind of separates from themselves and they lose access to their emotions and access to their sense of self. Otherwise, you have people re-experiencing the trauma. So at any time they have the trauma triggered, they go into fight or flight mode as if they need to protect themselves.
Yeah.
And so all these things that happen make it incredibly difficult to do therapy for PTSD. Traditionally, trauma therapy is actually very difficult for people to go through because the goal is to bring up these traumatic issues and process them and come to terms with them. But that can be an incredibly difficult process to go through when your body is trying to protect you from getting there.
Yeah.
So some of the things that we see with MDMA, and this is something that I've taught entire lectures on, is what MDMA does in the brain that allows people to actually have access to those memories. And so just in short, MDMA creates changes in our brain that allows our PTSD response to turn down enough, and it allows people to connect with their emotions in a stronger way, to allow them to access those traumas and look at them with more compassion and understanding.
Wow.
And be able to process them and understand them in a different way. And it's that process that creates long-term healing, long-term benefit.
Wow. What a beautiful drug. How is that not something that we all can have access to? But you can have access to, you know, these other pretty intense, chemically changing, brain-changing drugs.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, there's a lot of thoughts on why MDMA specifically became a Schedule I substance. One thing to note is that, of course, psychedelic compounds can be abused, and they're not 100% safe in every situation, and I think that they need to be used with caution and awareness and preparation and doing these things in a safe and controlled therapeutic atmosphere has shown to be incredibly safe, actually far safer than other pharmaceuticals that are used. But the reality is that taking these drugs, buying them from the black market, using things that may or may not actually be MDMA, which is very common, it poses some risk.
Yes.
So that's one part. The other part is that when in 1985, just a little history on MDMA, up until 1985, MDMA was actually a legal substance that was used widely in psychotherapy. And it was actually seen as kind of a cure-all treatment for many different things in therapy. It can just create a strong therapeutic atmosphere to work on many different things.
Yeah, it kind of opens you up.
It can open up access and compassion in different ways. And it actually started to be used as a recreational substance. And people were kind of using it as an alternative to alcohol in some ways. But in 1985, the DEA decided to come down hard on MDMA and schedule it as an illicit substance. And in the process of that, there were court cases where psychologists and psychiatrists, the medical professionals, were trying to get MDMA to remain a legal medication. And in that decision, the judge actually decided that MDMA should be Schedule 3, so meaning it should be a legal medication that can be used just like other medications.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the DEA decided to put it on Schedule 1.
Wow.
So since 1985, the DEA went against the judge's ruling to make it an illicit substance.
Wow. That's actually very interesting that that went down that way. Wonder why that would be, you know? Now, minus MDMA. So MDMA is really good for, I mean, it's good for many uses and purposes and treatments other than just PTSD. But that being the main one, what would you say psilocybin mushrooms would be used for?
Yeah, and I would note that just before we move on to psilocybin with MDMA, that it's, I think it's the perfect medication for PTSD. We've also seen that it has some benefit for anxiety associated with terminal illness, so people who are in late-stage cancer or palliative care. But I do want to note that MDMA is not good for everything. So there are risks associated with MDMA if somebody has bipolar disorder or major depressive disorder. So there are some things that you want to be careful with MDMA to just recognize that it's just like all of these medications, any medication, we just need to be really mindful about how we use it, what we use it for,
yeah,
and knowing the indications. So I just wanted to state that.
Yeah, that's important.
Right, so psilocybin, or the main psychedelic compound in magic mushrooms, has been studied really for a range of different things. And so this is research that's been happening at NYU, Johns Hopkins, UCLA, UC San Francisco. There's a number of different major universities that have taken on studying psilocybin.
That's awesome.
And so there's been really cool research that's looked at a number of things. Kind of one of the major starting points was major depressive disorder.
Major depressive disorder, huh?
Right, so people with severe depression, also treatment resistant, people who have tried other medications and not found benefit. In some of those studies, it was found that even just one dose of psilocybin had profound antidepressant effects.
Wow.
For people.
That is profound. That is like... Mm-hmm. It's insane. It's been hiding from us under our nose the whole time, you know, and some of us, some people have been kind of, preaching that the word about those things and these drugs and the magic of them in a sense, and, you know, the dogma surrounding it. Like, I can only imagine explaining this to like my grandparents, you know, it just like explaining the possibilities of some of the potentials of these drugs, is just, it's almost unbelievable, you know? It's like, I would say, as you just described, that it can help severe depression. Because there are people out there who are severely depressed with no end, with no sight to an end. And, you know, hear you say that and are just, their first question is how? Like, how can that happen after one session or could happen?
Yeah. So, there's different sides to think about. So I think with many of these medications, I think about it that there's a pharmacological side. So talking about what happens in the brain and in the body that can allow for antidepressant effect.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the experiential side. So what is actually happening on this psychedelic experience that can help people change their perspectives and change the way that they're seeing the world, seeing themselves, and eventually changing how they live. So part of that with psilocybin, you know, a lot of these psychedelics have a range of different things that they do in the brain. But what, some of the maybe two important things that I'll touch on for psilocybin is similar to other classic psychedelics like LSD, psilocybin works a lot on serotonin, and specifically on a serotonin 5-HT2A receptor site.
Serotonin is your happy chemical?
So serotonin is a neurotransmitter, so it's a brain messenger that I think of a lot in connection with balance. So I can think about when serotonin is low, we might be out of balance. So our sleep system gets off, our appetite is off, our mood gets off. When our serotonin is more balanced, we see those things fall into place more. And just having, you know, balance in our life can be good for our mood.
Yeah.
So sleeping well, eating well, having good energy and exercising, those things are really key for maintaining positive mood.
Got it. But if you had a rush of serotonin, it would be feel like happy, right? Overwhelming happy. Because dopamine is what's responsible for love. That's the love chemical, correct?
So not so.
Or I got that all missed.
Neurotransmitters are more complex than we think.
Okay.
Neurotransmitters do a lot of different things in different parts of the brain, and it's not quite as simple as saying that this neurotransmitter does something specific.
Okay.
Because in reality, the feeling of love is probably a mix of dopamine creating pleasure, serotonin creating a sense of balance and enjoyment, oxytocin. So all of these things come together.
Got it.
To create those really complex emotions. So that's why I said I think of serotonin more as a balance creating neurotransmitter.
Cool.
but it also does a lot of other things. It's actually hugely complex. So we see serotonin 5-HT2A is impacted by psilocybin. So it does that in a couple ways by blocking reuptake of serotonin. So I won't talk too much about that, but it basically just means that it allows more serotonin to be in the synapse, so in between neurons of our brain. And so it allows more serotonin to be taken up in our brain. And psilocybin also, as a molecule, looks very, very similar to serotonin. And so it actually can, in some ways, trick our brain into thinking that there's more serotonin in there.
That's pretty cool.
So that's one piece. It's very interesting how it works.
Yeah, wow.
And so something that happens when psilocybin is in the brain and it's altering serotonin in that way is it can get your brain communicating in ways that it doesn't normally communicate. So normally our brain has a pretty specific pattern that it works in. It kind of helps us get through our day-to-day in the same pattern. We go through kind of our default living mode. So our brain doesn't have to be constantly relearning and adapting all the time. It figures out what you do on a daily basis, and it just kind of goes into automatic mode after a while. And so that can be really good for saving energy, and it can be really good for, you know, not having to learn new things all the time. Yeah. But when you're not in the healthiest behaviors, when you're not living the way that is really good for you, it can be really hard to get your brain out of that default network.
So like bad habits.
So bad habits can get really ingrained. For example, someone with depression, when you're living in a depressed way, it becomes very ingrained in the way you live. So that's why it can be, when you have depression, it's especially hard to change behavior. It's especially hard to try new things. So something that psilocybin does is it can turn off this, what's called the default mode network.
Wow.
And that default mode network is that thing that keeps our brain being somewhat rigid. And so it allows for you to think outside the box and see things differently. It allows your brain to communicate in ways that it doesn't normally. And part of that is having these parts of your brain that are not necessarily meant to communicate put together. So, for example, some people on higher doses of psilocybin might have their auditory system of their brain and their visual system of the brain communicating in ways they don't normally. And so we can see sometimes people experience something called synesthesia.
Yeah, fascinating. The mixing of the senses, right?
Yeah. Right, so your different senses are connecting. So you might hear someone talk about being able to hear sound. I'm sorry, see sound.
Yeah.
See sound is color.
Yeah.
Or taste sound. So these different different senses start to communicate in ways that we normally don't have access to.
Very fascinating. Very fascinating stuff. So it makes me think of the stoned ape theory. And it's kind of all of the science you're describing and the way that it chemically works on our brain. For those people who aren't aware, the stoned ape theory is the idea that we as human beings, our ancestors, primates, have evolved using psilocybin in their diets, and they believe it's what explains the doubling of the human brain size, and it's what created human beings today and these conscious, imaginative, creative creatures that we are.
Right, exactly. So that was something that Terence McKenna spoke about quite a bit, this idea that from primates eating wild mushrooms that contain psilocybin, that it created this blossoming of our neuronal network and expansing of our consciousness.
Yeah, it's a pretty crazy theory to think about when it comes to plugging in the use of psilocybin with our ancestors. It definitely makes a lot of sense when it comes to that, but it still is a hypothesis. It's definitely not a theory, but the more research coming out about it that we learn about today and how it works on our brain gives more fuel to that. I swear, every time I hear more stuff about it, it's like you could plug it right into that hypothesis pretty well.
Yeah, so it's one of the interesting things that we're talking about more now is that, we really focus, MAPS and these other organizations really focus the first stage of research on psychedelics as clinical treatments. So focusing on, can we help sick people get better? Mm-hmm. And can this help clinical conditions? But there is also, the understanding or the belief that many of us have, either from having these experiences ourselves or knowing people that have had it, is can these substances also help healthy people get better? Can healthy people have better lives, have better awareness, better access to themselves with the proper use of these substances? And I'm actually involved in doing a study for actually the first modern study looking at healthy participants is a study between NYU and Johns Hopkins, where they're looking at psilocybin being used with religious professionals.
Wow.
So these are leaders in different religious fields. All were given the psilocybin-assisted treatment. And so my team is interviewing these religious professionals at different intervals following their treatment to understand what that experience was like, how they've incorporated it into their life, how it's changed how they see things and how they live. So it's been a very interesting development.
What are they saying? Are they having full-blown mystical experiences?
In a lot of cases. So that's, that's one of the things with psilocybin is that it's one of these compounds that can induce what we call mystical experience. And people experience that different ways, but for some people that can look like connecting with a higher power or connecting with the interconnectedness of the universe, or experiencing experiencing things outside of our normal
understanding.
Right. Ego dissolution or ego death is usually thought to be one of the farthest reaches.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. So psilocybin, one of the common effects from taking it is it causing a mystical experience. What do you define as a mystical experience besides what you just told me? Like, is it, as what I would consider it, it's something you can't really compare any other experience to. It's a life-changing experience.
Right. So that's, you know, that whole idea of how do we describe these experiences that we don't really have language for has been a huge question in this field because we're trying to study things that are very difficult to grasp.
Yeah.
You know, some of the experiences that people have on psychedelics, there's no reasonable language for. They're called ineffable experiences. But we try and put language to them to try and understand them. So as far as, you know, you ask what is a mystical experience, and it's one of those things that we try and define. So there's a measure that people generally do in these studies called the Mystical Experience Questionnaire.
Wow.
And so that actually asks about, you know, many different possible experiences of mysticism or mystical experience. And they use that to kind of determine did this person have what we would call it a mystical experience or did they not?
How fascinating.
So it's, you know, it speaks to kind of how we try and define these things. And we're getting better and better at it, but still understanding that, you know, these things are developing. We're developing how to really study these things that are, you know, outside of our realm of understanding.
Yeah. How fascinating. We'll stick with the science talk and the psychology talk, but, you know, as you say that as well, it makes me think of our ancestors using it and how much it was involved in religious practices prior to modern day. You know, that could be, I guess, responsible for a lot of mystical experiences that you would hear about throughout history. You know, it's pretty interesting.
Absolutely, they're. So psychedelics have been used, you know, in basically as long as we have human record, psychedelics have been used, and largely in religious practice, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
So a lot of the religious experiences that people have taken place with the addition of psychedelic compounds.
Yeah, yeah. And most religions across time and the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, our dogma around it is very misleading to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think so. And that's, you know, it's one of the interesting things about talking about these new treatments. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the ways that as a community, I think there's part of the community that has decided that medicalization is the way to reach people and to reach the public, to talk about these as medications, to show that they can treat specific ailments that are very difficult to treat. You know, I think it was a brilliant move to focus MDMA on post-traumatic stress disorder. One, because I think it just, they naturally go together. It's an amazing medication for PTSD. But also, it's really difficult to say that you don't want veterans to heal.
Yeah.
You know, to hear that there's some treatment that could help all these people that have not been able to get better, it's really hard to argue against that.
Yeah. Now with LSD, is that on the same page as psilocybin? Is the, I guess, effect similar chemically on your brain and stuff?
Yeah, so LSD is another classic psychedelic. So it similar action. It does act differently in some ways, but similarly, it works on 5-HT2A serotonin receptor site primarily. And I guess for the purposes of this discussion, it has more similarities with psilocybin than with other things like MDMA.
Okay. And is it dangerous? Because I know there's a lot of people, the stigmatization surrounding LSD or acid, whatever street name you use it for, is it dangerous for people to use? Of course, controlled environments are always important, but is it physically harmful to you?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things with the psychedelics that a lot of people don't understand is that pharmacologically and safety-wise, they're actually some of the safest compounds that we can actually put in our bodies.
Wow.
LSD, for example, is active at a microgram level. So a normal dose of LSD can be less than 100 micrograms. Hmm. So that's an incredibly, incredibly small amount of a substance to have a psychoactive effect.
Hmm.
And people have been known to take hundreds or thousands of times a normal dose of LSD and not overdose or not had prolonged psychiatric difficulties or prolonged physical effect.
Interesting.
And I usually talk about it as like as humans, we can't take thousands of doses of anything without being poisoned. If you drink 100 doses, normal doses of water, you can be poisoned.
Yeah.
So in terms of ability to be poisoned, LSD is actually quite safe in a lot of ways. Our body processes it very quickly. There's not much evidence for long-term negative effect coming specifically from the compound.
Wow.
So there is, there's always those thoughts and those old stories about, this person took LSD and then became schizophrenic, or he never came back. He was always, he was always a burnout after he took acid once. And while I don't doubt that things like that have occurred, that there's been situations where somebody took a psychedelic and then had some major change, what seems most likely in those situations is it's likely somebody who was already on the verge of a psychotic break, already predisposed to psychosis, very likely kind of barely holding on to reality as we know it, and having a psychedelic experience can absolutely kick that over the edge.
Yeah.
And develop psychosis, because it is, similarly breaking that default mode network, allowing your brain to see things outside the box.
Now, how would you distinguish if you are a person who's on the break of losing their mind, or turning schizophrenic, or on the break of actually needing an experience like one of these to help them?
Yeah, that's an interesting call. I mean, as far as how we work with it in clinical practice, is we are very careful about monitoring the signs of early psychosis, and being aware of family history of psychosis, and past personal history of psychosis or major mood disorder, especially bipolar. So bipolar disorder has the possibility of having psychotic episodes connected to it. So often in the clinical trials, those things have been rule outs or exclusion factors for the treatment. So if somebody has a history of psychosis or a history of bipolar disorder, that we might say that, psilocybin or a classic psychedelic like LSD may not be an appropriate fit. Interesting. For that reason.
Interesting. So,
it's
a rigorous process to determine what they need and if they need it and how much and all of that stuff.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, as a clinician studying these compounds and the way they work in treatment, if there's one thing that I can really say, it's that I'm a really big proponent of the care of these compounds. I think they can be hugely beneficial when used with proper care and respect and understanding, as well as proper preparation, proper sentence setting, which we can talk about in a moment. But just basically having the things in line to have a positive experience and a safe experience. Mm-hmm. Without those things, these substances absolutely, you know, pose potential risks. So I do have concerns, as do most medications and most things we do. Mm-hmm. There are risks inherent, and we want to do whatever we can to control those risks.
Very interesting. So before I ask you that, actually, I want to touch up on one other drug that you are working with is ketamine. Ketamine, I know nothing really about. The other ones I was kind of familiar with, but what is ketamine and what are they using it for? What are you using
it for? So ketamine is a hugely interesting compound that I have become more acquainted with over the last year or so. Ketamine is a dissociative anesthetic medication. So ketamine is actually a Schedule 3 medicine. So it's actually a medicine that's legal to use. It's most commonly used for anesthesia. So it's regularly used for putting people under to have surgery.
Wow.
It was developed first and foremost as a field anesthetic for war, for military applications.
Wow.
And it's actually a really a well-sought-after anesthetic because it's very short-acting, so it only puts people under for about an hour and a half to 2 hours. Hmm. It's actually neuroprotective, and we've actually found it to be neuroregenerative, so it actually creates new neuronal growth in your brain for a period after taking ketamine.
What does that mean?
So it means that it triggers your neurons in your brain. So the systems in our brain, our communication systems, the things that hold memories and hold experiences, it allows them to grow in new ways and make new connections.
Whoa.
And that's the thing that, is not seen in many other substances. But that's one of the hypotheses now about why it might be so helpful for things like depression, similar to what we talked about earlier with psilocybin. In depression, generally someone's brain becomes very rigid. It gets used to working in a certain way. And that certain way is usually being depressed, feeling negative.
So it's not flexible at all. It's not malleable.
Exactly. It's very rigid. It's very hard to change. Hmm. And what we see in the days and weeks following a ketamine session is that people feel an openness and they feel a reduction in depression symptoms. And it's likely that in that time, new habits and new behaviors have a better chance of sticking and developing.
Wow.
So that's one thing. So ketamine, so like I said, even though it's used regularly as an anesthetic, it's able to be used off-label as a treatment for psychiatric conditions. And so we found that it has some pretty profound benefit for severe depression, for anxiety,
wow,
for obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD,
wow,
And it's one of the few compounds that is safe to use with severely suicidal clients.
Really?
It's actually been found to alleviate suicidal, especially chronic suicidal thoughts. Especially somebody who struggles with suicidal thoughts on a regular basis. Not particularly someone who's like, my girlfriend just left me and I'm suicidal now. Mm-hmm. It's not going to stop something like that. That, you know, there's a very particular reason why you feel that way. But for some people who are severely depressed, who just have this kind of chronic suicidal drive, we've seen it really turn the knob down.
Wow.
On suicide out. Yeah.
That's incredible.
And the other benefits of ketamine are that it's shown to be safe with bipolar disorder, which no other psychedelic is really appropriate for bipolar disorder.
Wow.
And on ketamine, clients can actually stay on whatever psychiatric medications they're taking, whereas with MDMA or psilocybin, it's most common for clients to have to get off of certain psychiatric medications because they might interfere with those medications.
So it sounds too good to be true, in a sense. Like if it's legalized, why when you go to the psychologist, they would put you on some antidepressants and mood stabilizers before ketamine?
Yeah, so ketamine is, even though we have known about its antidepressant effects since kind of the early mid-2000s, the first major paper talking about ketamine's use with major depression was in 2006, or right around there. But a number of practitioners that I know have been using it since the early 2000s and before. But only in the last 3 or 4 years, so since about 2016, 2017, is when it's actually really being more discussed as a frontline treatment for depression.
Good.
And so now it is actually the situation where, for example, I work at a program in San Francisco where we do ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. And so you can actually go to see a psychologist or a physician and be prescribed ketamine for major depressive disorder or severe anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder. So it is becoming more available. We're actually seeing some of the larger health companies are actually looking into ketamine as an alternative for treating depression.
And you're talking big pharma?
So, yeah, there's some interesting things with pharmaceutical companies and ketamine. So one of the fascinating or interesting things about ketamine is it's a generic medication that's not patentable. Because it's an old medication. We get it for dirt cheap. It's like $1 per dose of generic ketamine to treat somebody.
Wow.
And so many pharmaceutical companies have been trying to find a way to make ketamine patentable, or make a version of ketamine they could actually patent.
So they can charge it big money.
Exactly. And because ketamine also has these dissociative psychedelic effects in certain dose ranges, these pharmaceutical companies tried to create a version of ketamine that had the antidepressant effects but didn't have the psychoactive effects.
Oh, no.
In traditional medicine is to say that any psychoactive effect is a side effect that should be avoided. So they look at the effects of ketamine as what's called psychedomimetic, or inducing psychosis.
Oh.
Because they see psychoactive or psychedelic effect as a negative that should be avoided, where ultimately we see it, and there's more and more people in the medical field that see the psychoactive component of these substances as part of the healing potential.
Yeah. It seems like we're kind of a society deprived of experiencing those psychedelic experiences with any type of drug. And we're just now finally getting it back with marijuana and stuff like that. But I didn't know that's how they worked. They kind of deemed it based on if it causes a psychoactive experience, which makes sense because they don't want to cause psychosis. But the science shows that that's kind of what is helping, or what is part of what's helping.
Right. More and more of our evidence is showing that it is these mystical experiences or these altered states of consciousness that are providing at least a portion of the long-term healing benefit.
Wow.
So with ketamine, for example, we see there are still a number of clinics that use it in the sub-psychedelic range. And they actually will do ketamine infusions. So they hook somebody up to an IV and they actually give small amounts of ketamine over a long period of time.
Hmm.
So the goal is that they get enough ketamine in their system without having a psychoactive experience. And what we see from those experiences is that it does seem to have some antidepressant effects. It does seem to have some mood lifting effects, but they don't seem to last very long.
Hmm.
So we see that a lot of people who go to these kind of ketamine clinics, they have to continue the treatment. Sometimes it's, you know, they go three times a week for a few weeks, and then it goes down to, you know, maybe once every few weeks or once a month on an ongoing basis. But what we're seeing in using it more as we use it in low doses, but we also use it in higher doses in the psychedelic range. And we're seeing that when it is used in the higher dose range in conjunction with therapy, people are actually having more long-term benefits.
That is interesting.
So the experiences that they're having will actually help them to gain new perspectives, gain understandings, and make changes in their life that create more long-term health.
Wow. And, you know, that would make sense because having an experience over just a small IV drip, you attach more emotion and feeling to an experience when you actually are seeing and feeling and hearing and smelling something rather than just putting it in on a micro level, in a sense. So it makes sense that that's more changeable because of the experience, the jaw-dropping or, you know, profound mystical experience that you do have on these things.
Right. And another part of it is it makes the client an active part of their healing.
Yeah. You do the work yourself in a lot of them.
Exactly. So when you're just taking a medication or when you're going and you're sitting down and getting an infusion of ketamine, you're being told that you're not really, it doesn't matter what you do, this thing outside of you, this medication is what's going to help.
Yeah.
So as long as you take this medication, this thing that is inside of you that's broken is going to get better. And that makes it hard for people to get really connected to their therapy process. And they aren't really, it's hard to buy into that.
Yeah, it's not long-term.
It doesn't create a long-term connection or development. So we see in these more active therapy types that it really is set up as, like, you know, the amount of work that you do is going to create the amount of benefit that you have.
Wow.
People are a lot more engaged in the therapy process and finding benefit.
Wow. Some great work you're doing. Very, very great work.
Thank you. I love doing this work. I think it's fascinating. It's been amazing to see it become more open in the last few years. And there's been more open discussion about these treatments happening, more people agreeing that it should be moving forward.
Yeah.
So it's been really beautiful to see. I mean, this was not how it was, you know, 8-10 years ago when I when I got started.
It's moving very quick, and I think the evidence is just, it's irrefutable once you look at it and hear about it. And actually, if you experience it yourself, I mean, it sells itself. It you know, I really think that this is going to have a profound impact on humanity in general once they are looked at in a different way, like they should be. And, you know, where do you see this going in the years to come? What do you see the future like when it comes to mental illness and wellness?
Yeah, I mean, I think you said at one point that something about seeing how this these types of treatments and how organizations like MAPS can create a change in the atmosphere of health and wellness. And I really see that you know, an organization like MAPS was led the charge for MDMA specifically. Having a pharmaceutical company that is a nonprofit organization, that they actually have another arm that is a public benefit corporation as well. So you have this organization that's completely focused on creating something that's good for humanity and that's good for treating people. And MAPS has been 100% funded by donations. And so they're not beholden to pharmaceutical companies for profit. They're not beholden to health organizations that want the treatment to look a certain way. Their entire mission is creating a treatment that's beneficial for people and that works for people. And I think this model of a public benefit goal, it really shifts the ability to focus on treatments that can work even though they may not be hugely profitable. So yeah. I think that's been a huge limitation in our medical system, is that in order for something to be viable, it needs to be extremely profitable.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has really limited the amount of things that could be helpful and could be beneficial to people from accessing the community.
Yeah. So you're in the years to come, you see this as a medication that is widely accepted and used to help treat people in the categories we touched up on, and possibly much more.
Absolutely. So MDMA is in the final round of FDA clinical trials right now. It's in phase 3 clinical trials. It is set to be approved as a medication, likely in 2022.
Wow.
It was recently opened for what's called expanded access. And so what that means is that the FDA, I think in 2018, called MDMA its breakthrough therapy of the year. So the FDA said that the results from these MDMA therapy trials are so successful and it's proving to be so safe that they want to fast track its process of becoming legal.
Good for them. That is awesome to hear.
Absolutely. And they, designated MDMA as the breakthrough therapy, and they moved it into what's called an expanded access. And so that means that for medications that are still in the clinical trial process, but that show a certain level of safety and efficacy, that they want it to become available to people who need it before the clinical trial process, because that takes many, many years.
Wow.
So now for the first time, it proved to be given to people, some people outside of clinical trials. So that's a huge development that actually just happened in February this year in 2020.
That's amazing. We're looking at in the next decade for sure. It'll be in every state, accessible to everybody who needs it clinically, at least clinically.
It should be. So that's it'll be an FDA approved medication. It'll likely be a Schedule 3 medication, meaning that any prescriber with an FDA license will be able to prescribe it. The caveat with MDMA therapy, which I think is a really good thing, is that it's not going to be something where prescribers have the ability to prescribe it however they want. Mm-hmm. It's always going to be in the context of this therapy process. And there's a lot of controls over how that looks.
Meaning so you can't just go in there and say that I just got out of a bad relationship, I'm feeling depressed. Like there's a rigorous process to get to that point.
Right. There's going to be a rigorous process of making sure it's safe for a particular person, mm-hmm. and that it's going to be that they are dealing with something that we know that MDMA is good for. And it's a process where there's a lot of therapy involved. Every time you take MDMA, it's in the company of two therapists.
Okay.
And these are 8-hour intensive therapy sessions.
Wow.
With the person on MDMA. So these are not, you know, it's not a fun, easy thing that somebody would want to do.
Yeah.
It's really something that's like, you wouldn't want to have to do this unless you really, really needed it.
Yeah.
Because it's an intensive process. We've actually, when I've interviewed a lot of the participants who went through the MDMA trials, one of the things that we were looking for was if anybody was seeking out MDMA in the year following. Because that's one of the big concerns, is if you're giving people these drugs, they're going to want to start taking them over and over. But what we found is that these participants see MDMA in the context of this really difficult trauma-focused therapy. And so they didn't have a great time. You know, they had a very difficult time.
Yeah.
And the MDMA made it a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them had said, like, I can't imagine taking this drug and going dancing. I can't imagine why people would do that. Because for me, it was intensive therapy process. So we found that it's actually a deterrent for people to take MDMA in the future, which is interesting.
You mean taking it in a not a clinical setting?
Yeah, so taking it when people have taken it in this therapeutic context, we found that they're less likely to take it outside of a clinical context.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, that's also good. So you slow down recreational use and abuse.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So right. Now, are you, as a psychologist, are you required to have a session of your own? Are you required to try it your own?
So that's part of the, you know, that is part of this this process, and the idea that for us to be effective,
yes,
or to have a certain understanding of how to be a psychedelic therapist, it is really helpful to know what these substances are doing and what it's like to be on the other side of that therapy relationship.
Almost like so shamans.
What was that?
Almost like a shaman, you know, like someone who kind of walks you through it or has done it many times on his own, so he kind of knows what you're actually feeling or experiencing, right?
Definitely, definitely. And even, you know, as psychologists, you know, a huge part of almost all of our programs, if not all of them, is that we have to go through our own psychotherapy, and we have to have our own, you know, our own therapy practice to understand what that's like, and to, you know, to just dig up our stuff and make sure we're not going into it with a bunch of baggage.
Yeah.
So part of the training process for MDMA-assisted psychotherapy, not everybody who's gone through the training has done this, but there is the possibility of doing an MDMA-assisted psychotherapy session for yourself in the training. And that's something that's actually part of the FDA protocol, and they have been using that because part of the FDA requirements is that there's a certain number of healthy participants that get the treatment, and so that's how they've been getting these healthy participants is it's actually the people going through the training process.
Wow.
To be MDMA-assisted yeah. psychotherapist.
Cool.
So I haven't been through that specific part of the training yet. I was in a specialized training for ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. I was in that for about 4 months with an intensive training program. And part of that is an experiential training. But the way that that works and the way for it to be accessible and legal is that each person has to have some clinical condition that is appropriate to treat with ketamine. So it's not like anybody can just walk in and legally get ketamine prescribed for them.
Yeah.
You actually have to have a diagnosis or a past diagnosis for one of the approved conditions.
Got it. Well, that's good to know that there's not many loopholes and you have to really need it in order to get it.
Yeah.
Which I would say other drugs should be like, but they hand out those like candy sometimes with the mood stabilizers and antidepressants and stuff.
Yeah, and I would say one of the great things about a lot of the people who practice with these medicines is we're all incredibly mindful and incredibly careful about how we work with them.
Mm-hmm.
Because we understand that the field is under a microscope.
Yeah.
There's a lot of eyes on how it goes in this time. And we're also just really aware that we want treatments to be beneficial for people. We don't want to put people in harm's way. We want to be really careful about how we're using them and making sure that everything we're doing is above board and legal.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool stuff. Are you currently, you're saying you're currently in a study with ketamine, correct?
So right now I'm actually I work in my clinical practice with ketamine. Mm-hmm. So I'm in a program in San Francisco called Healing Realms. We are a ketamine-assisted therapy practice. So it's not part of a clinical trial, but we're legally able to work with clients.
Wow.
Who are appropriate for ketamine therapy. I do have a couple ketamine trials that are coming up. So we have one in the works that is going to be assessing the indication of using ketamine for palliative care clients, so people in the last stages of cancer. And that's going to be an at-home treatment where we actually go to people's homes who are in the last stages of palliative care and provide ketamine-assisted therapy to process fears around death and dying and come to terms with the idea of passing.
Wow, that's beautiful work.
Yeah, it's definitely shown to be an interesting tool for that indication.
So another thing I wanted to touch up on is you mentioned one of these drugs helping with addiction. And I live out of Chicago over in Indiana, and we have one of the highest rates of heroin opiate abuse in our area. And, you know, a lot of people from high school that I went to school with, you know, ended up down that path, and it's mm-hmm. everywhere around us. And, you know, I was wondering, as one of the big epicenters of the heroin epidemic, which one is best for addiction and the promise of which one, you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm actually one of the people who has focused a lot on addiction and treating addiction with psychedelics. So I think there is the possibility for these compounds to be hugely beneficial in treating addiction. So they all have, so whether we're talking about ketamine MDMA or psilocybin, they all have potential utility for depression if used a certain way. They all just go about it in slightly different ways.
Okay.
So I think, so for example, there is a clinical trial happening in the UK by Dr. Ben Sessa, who's an amazing psychiatrist who's been developing treatments for addiction and alcoholism with MDMA. And the focus of that is treating underlying trauma. So that speaking to the idea that a lot of people who are abusing substances or an addiction may have some kind of underlying traumas or emotional difficulties, and that's a part of why they're in this cycle of use. And if they're able to work through those emotional difficulties, that they won't have as much drive to use substances. So that's, I would think, if you are working with someone with addiction that does, that clearly that's a part of their story and that's a part of what's going on, that MDMA would be a potential benefit. I think for other cases, if it's just needing the ability to help somebody break out of a mindset or break out of their habitual pattern, that ketamine or psilocybin show promise for doing that.
Wow. That's,
and so they, yeah.
Those are some really promising words to hear, because I have lost, you know, a lot of people in my life to some of that stuff, and to hear this stuff being fought for, there's this, you know, a war going on trying to get these things legalized and almost convince people that they should be. You are fighting a good war, you know, and I hope this video can reach to people who may have these stigmatizations surrounding a lot of these drugs. So for when they do see these things up for legalization and trying to push for it, they, you know, we can erase some of that, those thoughts behind it, you know, because out here, I know in California where you're at, it's the you guys are a little ahead of time. Compared to us out here, we're a little still old-fashioned. We still have weed. You know, you could still get thrown in jail for the smallest amount of weed. So it's pretty.
Right.
There's a lot that still needs to be learned, and a lot of people still need to learn about this. Because even people who are into the psychedelic community aren't aware of the medical purposes for it. So what would you tell somebody? As one of our closing, you know, topics, what would you tell somebody who is still not convinced yet after hearing this? What would you tell someone who may still think it's just for a bunch of hippies and people who, you know, who are druggies? You know, you got that stigmatization behind it. And clearly, as a psychologist, you know that that's not the case.
Yeah. I mean, what I generally speak to is, you know, I think in a lot of those cases that speaking to it from a standpoint of medicalization can be effective. So speaking about it, that it's we've never seen a treatment as effective for post-traumatic stress disorder as MDMA. We have there's been countless lives saved with ketamine, you know, that these medications provide access to deep therapeutic states. So I don't know. I mean, I guess in my thought, I don't know that my goal is to convince anybody. I'm happy to have those conversations. I think it's important that we have the conversations, and that I'm okay with people not believing in it or not feeling that it's the right way to go about working with people or treating with people, or treating people rather.
That's a good answer. That's a good answer. As long as it does help the people who are seeking it, you know, but I hope that by what you're doing and the work you're doing and the conversations we are having, you know, it does make its way across the United States. You know, if it wasn't for you people doing your clinical studies and really fighting for what you believe and what you see is can help people, we wouldn't be where we are with it today. You know, if it wasn't for companies like MAPS fighting for the legalization, even when it was, you know, deemed, you know, highly illegal, a lot of these drugs were deemed highly illegal, they stayed in the game because they understood the potential of it. And that to me is a really beautiful thing. And I appreciate your work, and I know that everyone else does, people who are hearing this, who are struggling with a lot of this stuff. You know, we really appreciate what you guys are all doing.
Thank you. Yeah, there's a lot of people who have given their lives to this cause and have been working for decades and decades to get us where we are now. And I feel really lucky to have had the opportunity to join this movement and make it my career and you know, do as much work with it as I have. But I really, you know, I owe it a lot to the people that have been doing this work for a long time and have devoted their lives to getting these treatments available for people who need them.
Yeah, I can see that. It's a very humbling position that you're in, being a part of that good fight, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that I get to, you know, enjoy every day and do something that I'm really passionate about and interested in. So yeah, I feel pretty lucky to do it.
Well, I'm glad you gave us the opportunity to interview you and pick your brain on this amazing topic. And I really, really hope to have more conversations with you. And Purdue, my class group, really appreciates it too. Hopefully we can get this out to a lot of eyes and you know, make a change out there.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to chat more when the opportunity comes up.
Yeah, great. I'd love to keep up with some of your studies and stuff as well. See how all that's going.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you everybody for listening. We're going to end this now and have a good one.